Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it is a busy day on Capitol Hill today. Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions was interrupted by protesters as he began the first of 2 days of confirmation hearings to become the next attorney general. Lawmakers are also hearing today from the heads of U.S. intelligence agencies about Russian hacking during the election. And meanwhile, there is growing opposition among Senate Republicans to the idea of repealing Obamacare without a replacement. Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin joins us now. Senator, welcome back.
Well, Jeremy, Happy New Year.
Well, and what is the latest plan at this point among Republicans in the Senate when it comes to Obamacare? Is it repeal and replace right away, or repeal and delay, or something else?
Well, I think there are a number of plans. I think set up a process where we can maybe start repairing the damage and working toward a system that actually works without any Democratic support, which is not my preferred solution. I think we ought to be doing is, rather than talking about repeal and replace, we ought to be talking about repair the damage and transition to a system that actually works. I think there's an awful lot of people that have that similar type of viewpoint. So it's a work in process because this is incredibly complex. Our first goal should be do no harm and then start repairing the damage that's already been done.
Do you think that Republicans, though, would be willing to repeal before there's a plan for replacement?
Well, we're certainly not going to blow up the market and pull out the rug out from under people and let people high and dry. I just left a meeting with my Wisconsin State Insurance Commissioner, a couple other state insurance commissioners, and I think the main point of that is, turn this back over to the states. We actually do know how to regulate insurance. The national model hasn't worked out that well. We've learned a fair amount of lessons, and give us the flexibility to regulate insurance and actually enact real reforms, real market reforms that constrain costs and provide greater access to better quality care.
But have you seen a plan of those reforms, something that could be done right away, or do you think that it's going to take some time before there's a replacement plan that's on the table?
Well, one of the points made is, our insurance commissioner said it's going to take time for the markets to heal themselves, to reconstitute into a non-federally regulated system. It's going to take time for states to react. I mean, some legislators only meet once every couple of years. So I don't think there's going to be anything instantaneous, particularly something that starts devolving insurance power back to the states, which is what I think the long-term solution would be here. And I think an awful lot of Americans start agreeing with that, too. They've taken a look at all the promises made under Obamacare, a reduced health care cost. Well, that hasn't panned out. The fact if you like your health care plan, you can keep it. They've seen Washington, D.C., the federal government, botch this, and I think they're probably more than willing to let the states give it another shot.
But it sounds like what you're saying is that you would prefer to leave that broken system in place than just take it away before there's a plan to replace it.
Well, it's funny. Lamar Alexander, he's very good at providing analogies and said if you had a bridge that's about ready to collapse, the first thing you would do is you'd start working to repair that bridge. You weren't going to blow it up. I mean, at least people have a bridge to use. Repair that so people can use it while you start building the other bridges. It's not a bad analogy. I think that's what we're talking about, a broken system here. Let's shore up that bridge. Let's repair that damage while we start working on the bridges. And it may be multiple bridges. It could be a number of different approaches. But things like in Wisconsin, we had a high-risk pool that worked really well. Not perfect. I think we've learned some things that would actually address people with the pre-existing conditions, the high-risk patients. There are far better approaches. I'd rather see 50 states provide those models rather than have one-size-fit-all model in the federal government here that, let's face it, Obamacare has been a miserable failure. It has not even come close to living up to its name, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act.
So, Senator, if somebody's out there with insurance through the Affordable Care Act or somebody works in a hospital or in the insurance industry, when are they going to know, or when are we going to know what's going to happen with Obamacare?
it's going to take a while. Again, it's very complex. Obamacare has been in place now for a number of years. It's done some real harm to our not only insurance markets, but just our health delivery markets, and it's going to take time to repair that damage. But I think everybody should rest assured that nobody here wants to pull out the rug from under people, leave them high and dry without access to quality health care. So it's a goal we all share. I mean, we should concentrate on that. Everybody wants every American to have access to affordable and quality health care. How do you achieve that goal? We start getting some divisions, but it is what we're all striving to do. If we keep that in mind, if we work in good faith with the other side, hopefully we can repair the damage and transition to something that actually works.
That's Ron Johnson, Republican senator from Wisconsin. Thanks so much for joining us.
Have a great day.
Well, we spoke here last week about corporations forming rapid response teams to react to a possible negative tweet from Donald Trump. Now there's a company, Trigger Finance, which is offering its customers Trump Triggers, an app that will alert you if the president-elect tweets negatively about a company you own stock in. But investors are preparing for the opposite Trump effect as well. First Trump Trust Portfolios, that's a firm based in Wheaton, Illinois, has created two election portfolios, stocks the company thinks will do well under President Trump. They each have 30 stocks spread across six sectors. That includes banking, infrastructure. Brian Westbury is chief economist for First Trust. And Brian, familiar names here. You think Caterpillar will benefit with infrastructure spending. Health and finance companies might benefit from fewer regulations. Raytheon is here. You expect an increase in defense spending. But Donald Trump has also dissed defense companies for overspending, most recently Boeing. Isn't this risky? Donald Trump can be both negative and positive.
Exactly. And we're perfectly aware of that. There are 30 stocks, so none of them are more than 4% of the portfolio. And you can have a hit to one of those stocks without having it affect the portfolio dramatically overall. But the key thing is we pick stocks using quantitative measures. In other words, we go back and look at their history and their earnings and the way we value them, the price of the stock versus the value of the company. And that's how they make it into the portfolio, not just because they're a company that Donald Trump may or may not favor, but they're in a sector that should do well. In the end, if he wants to spend more on defense, Boeing is going to be involved. Even though he might go after them, these companies have obviously ways to react. And if they do better in a macro environment, this portfolio should do very well as well.
We've already seen so many changes, though, in promises. It seems as if your predictions are based on promises. And we've already seen President-elect Trump say, well, Mexico won't pay for the wall initially. And we're seeing, if you Google stock market and Trump bubble, you get a lot of concern that what's going on right now in the stock market, it's, you know, zooming, as well as John Crudell in a Trump-friendly paper, the New York Post writes, this idea of buying stock as a Trump rally is as silly as they come. Crises around the world are being ignored. Economies everywhere are slowing. And he goes on to say that what's happening right now may be inflated. For instance, Trump's close friend Carl Icahn invested $1 billion into the stock market right after the election. And this writer, John Crudell, is one who thinks that it's sort of rigged, that this whole thing is a house of cards about to fall. Do you worry about putting so many Trump-based items in one basket? That's exactly how you're not supposed to invest.
Yeah, that is true. And I would argue John Crudell has been bearish for a long time, looking for other shoes to drop. And the market's gone up. Many, many people looked at things that President Obama did and thought they would be bad for the market. But really what drives corporations and the stock market over time is entrepreneurship and innovation. And we live in a great era of innovation. And so what we believe is that you invest over time, and you don't try to worry about a tweet, and you don't try to worry about one news story, because investing is really the way to create wealth. So that's why we created this portfolio.
Are you worried about Trump's trade stances, you know, the sudden protectionist trade ideas coming from a Republican? This could mean that somebody who makes cell phone chips for Apple could suddenly find themselves on the losing end.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the reasons why these large tech companies have underperformed since the election. There are a lot of worries And I am. I am worried about trade protectionism. I think it had a lot to do with the Great Depression. Infrastructure spending it's hard to do. There are so many environmental regulations. There are so many things that get in the way. This idea of shovel-ready projects, there's just not that many of them out there. But as investors, we want to buy companies that are valued correctly or even cheap relative to the market and hold on to them in an environment where they should do well. And that's why we invented this portfolio, and that's why investors seem to really like it right now.
Is this a gimmick?
No. Coming up to the election, I speak all the time. We talk to financial advisors across the country. I talked to over 10,000 of them last year. And one of the biggest questions we got is which sectors of the market will perform well if Hillary Clinton wins or if Donald Trump wins.
And would you have done this if Hillary Clinton had won?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. This is the way financial advisors and investors think. We know that policy matters, and so a shift in policy or a continuation in policy makes a difference for what sectors you would invest in.
Brian Westbury, Chief Economist for First Trust Advisors. Brian, thank you.
Hey, thank you, Robin.
Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, President-elect Donald Trump's nominee for Attorney General, the country's top law enforcement official, is taking questions from the Senate Judiciary Committee today and into tomorrow. Here's Sessions giving his opening statement to the committee.
You know that I revere the Constitution, that I'm committed to the rule of law, and you know that I believe in fairness, in impartiality, and equal justice under law. Over the years, you've heard me say many times that I love the Department of Justice. The Office of Attorney General of the United States is not a normal political office, and anyone who holds it must have total fidelity to the laws and the Constitution of the United States. He or she must be committed to following the law. He or she must be willing to tell the president or other top officials if he or they overreach. He or she cannot be a mere rubber stamp.
Well, ahead of today's hearings, critics wondered if Sessions would be able to cross Donald Trump to tell him no, Sessions being one of the first lawmakers to support Trump, and Trump in turn may be rescuing Jeff Sessions from a bit of a political purgatory. Sessions is extremely popular in his home state, Alabama, but has been considered too far right for many in his own party. So let's be reminded why. Emily Bazelon is staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. Hi, Emily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's pick up on that issue of whether Jeff Sessions can be independent from a Donald Trump. At the start, there was an exchange between Sessions and the Republican Chuck Grassley. Grassley asking what Sessions would do as AG in any investigations into Hillary Clinton. Here's part of Jeff Sessions' answer.
Mr. Chairman, it was a highly contentious campaign. I, like a lot of people, made comments about the issues in that campaign with regard to Secretary Clinton and some of the comments I made. I do believe that that could place my objectivity in question. I've given that thought. I believe the proper thing for me to do would be to recuse myself from any questions involving those kind of investigations that involve Secretary Clinton that were raised during
and
the
And Emily
campaign.
Grassley came back several times and said, do I hear you right? You'd recuse yourself? And he said he would. Many treated that as the news of the day, although David Corn of Mother Jones tweeted out that it felt kind of rehearsed, that the real purpose was to point out that the Democratic Attorney General Loretta Lynch had not recused herself from some questions. But your thoughts on this, was this as newsworthy as some are saying? And would Sessions as AG have to recuse himself from considerations of Hillary Clinton?
I think it was the right thing to say and a politically smart thing to say, especially since Donald Trump has already made it clear that he probably wouldn't ask the attorney general to investigate Hillary Clinton. I also think it's a pretty easy promise to make. I mean, the things that Sessions said about Clinton during the campaign, really did. They would be reason to question his objectivity since he seemed to conclude from the outset that she was guilty of something. So I'm not sure how much weight to really put into this.
Okay. Well, there were a number of protesters. There have been across the day. Well, let's just give a listen.
I also want to thank my dear friends.
No Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA.
Emily, take up the no KKK chant, a reference to comments that Sessions has made in the past. And now today he's defending his civil rights record, and listeners are going to hear this during the day. But take up the history here. Jeff Sessions appeared before this committee in 1986 when he was ultimately denied a federal judgeship, his critics saying that he said the KKK was okay until he found out that they smoked marijuana, that he reportedly called a white civil rights lawyer a disgrace to his race. Remind us of those comments at that time in 1986 and a case that preceded it in 1985.
Well, in 1986, Sessions said that those comments you referenced about the Klan were a joke, but he didn't deny making them. And that was, at that point, true of some other things he said about, for example, the NAACP being un-American, the disgrace comment that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Today, he definitively said he did not say those things. But at the time, he said, maybe I did, and that's disturbing. I don't know why I would have said them. Mm-hmm. So that's a difference between then and now. And you also mentioned a 1985 prosecution that Sessions brought for voter fraud against three black civil rights activists in Alabama. And that was a case that really haunted him at his hearings in the 80s, because those activists felt that they had been singled out for supposed absentee balloting irregularities in a place where the black vote had been chilled for a long time, where there were lots of allegations swirling around that white get-out-the-vote folks were misusing the absentee ballot. And so at that point, I should also say these civil rights activists were all acquitted by a jury. So yeah, that was a major problem for Sessions in 1986.
Well, take us a little deeper in this. These were three civil rights workers who were trying to get African-Americans to the polls very early in sort of the voting rights era. These are many elderly people who couldn't speak, who couldn't write, and they were helping them fill up the ballots, which was not illegal if they were helping them write what they wanted to be written. Sessions accused them of what?
Right. So Albert Turner was the main activist here. He was an advisor to Martin Luther King. And after the Voting Rights Act passed, he started organizing. Perry County, his county, was majority African-American, but had a history, not surprisingly, only of white office holders. So Turner and some other activists were trying to change that. And they were visiting rural black voters, many of them elderly, and explaining the ballot to them, helping them fill it out, and then mailing them. And what really stood out at their trial was that the U.S. attorney assistants for Sessions who were trying the case insisted that helping someone fill out their ballot with their permission could itself be a crime. That's just an exceptionally broad rendering of the law. And the judge in the case said it was, in fact, contrary to election law and the Constitution. And he threw out a number of the charges against the civil rights activists because of that.
Yeah, I think there was one family that said that maybe their vote had been changed by these people who were helping them. But the courtroom was flooded with African-Americans saying, no, this was exactly what I wanted to happen, and they were helping me make it happen. It left quite a wound. One of the activists that Jeff Sessions tried to prosecute in that case, and as you said, failed, is Evelyn Turner. And she spoke to CNN last night. Here she is.
Sessions has not changed. Have you ever known a leopard to change his spots? I haven't. Every time I see one, his spot's still there. Zebra, still striking. Sessions is still a racist.
Well, Sessions is, though, standing by his prosecution in 1985. He brought it up in his opening statement today, said he was protecting the integrity of the ballot. You know, to some it might be ancient history, to some, as we hear, very fresh. How much do you think this will be a factor in his quest to become attorney general?
Well, it's a Republican-controlled Senate, and Sessions is a popular senator among his colleagues. He had an introduction today from Susan Collins, who's viewed as a centrist. And so I think that there will be questions about this case and many other aspects of Sessions' record that are troubling to civil rights groups and LGBT groups and women's groups. I think it'll get aired, but the chances that his nomination will actually be blocked because of this, I think, are very low, given the composition of the Senate.
Talk about some of the other issues and what's possible, because he obviously is very different thinking than the previous 8 years of the Justice Department, very different thinking about immigration, about policing. What is in stone and what do you expect that Jeff Sessions as Attorney General might try to roll back?
You know, one of the big questions of the Department of Justice, especially when we're talking about civil rights enforcement or immigration, is how do you use the power of the federal government? So, for example, if you have a report of a, you know, shooting of an unarmed suspect in a city, and it seems like it could have been racially biased, does the Justice Department come in and investigate? Congress gave DOJ that power in 1994, said, you know, if there's evidence of a pattern or practice of violating civil rights laws, that the Department of Justice should investigate. And the Obama Justice Department has done a number of those investigations. Sessions has really opposed that approach. You know, some police departments welcome that kind of involvement from the federal government and others really push back. And Sessions has been on the side of police departments who say, no, we don't want the federal government looking into what we're doing. We want to be on our own.
What about, I mean, there are trains that may have left the station. Gay marriage, legalizing marijuana. He's very much against legalizing marijuana, for instance. Is that a movement that can be rolled back by an attorney general?
Yes, federal law still prohibits the possession of marijuana. And if Sessions wanted to get into a big fight with states that have legalized marijuana, like Colorado and Washington and a lot more, that's something he could do. I'm not sure if it's a likely fight that he'd pick, but he would have that power. And let's also mention immigration, because the Department of Justice oversees all of the country's immigration courts and detention centers. And so, again, there's a lot of power that an attorney general exercises here in conjunction with the Department of Homeland Security. And Sessions is the most right-wing senator on immigration. He backed a 2011 Alabama law that was the most restrictive in the country, and most of that was struck down in court. So again, we could see a real shift if he is attorney general.
Emily Bazelon, staff writer at The New York Times, a fellow at the Yale Law School, watching as we are the Senate confirmation hearings for Jeff Sessions, Donald Trump's nominee to be attorney general. Emily, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
The North American International Auto Show continues today in Detroit, and there have been some surprising headlines already, including the resurrection of cars like the Jeep Wagoneer and the Ford Bronco, made famous by the O.J. Simpson car chase. Michelle Krebs, senior analyst at Auto Trader, joins us with more. Michelle, first, why do you think these companies are bringing back these old cars?
Well, they're great names, and they had loyal followers, and also all those vehicles are in segments that are selling really well. Small trucks like the Ford Ranger, they haven't sold it in a few years, but GM came in with the Chevrolet Colorado and GMC Canyon a few years ago, and it is just booming sales. So Ford decided to jump on that bandwagon. And then all the others fall into the category of sport utility vehicles, and it just seems like Americans cannot get enough of sport utility vehicles.
And on the issue of the Bronco, you think we've gotten far enough away from the OJ chase that that is not associated with that anymore? Or with all these new shows coming out about OJ, does that actually help sales of the Bronco?
Good question, but it certainly is a brand name that everybody knows one way or the other. So it can't hurt. And you know, they've got a loyal following base that has wanted that Bronco back for a long time.
And these are big cars. Are we returning to an era of big SUVs?
Well, they're not huge, I mean, compared to the past. I have to say, people call these gas guzzlers. The auto industry has made amazing improvements in fuel economy. A decade ago, you might have gotten a truck that got fuel economy in the teens, maybe even the single digits. Now trucks are getting close to 30 miles per gallon, so they're not OJ's Bronco. We're seeing all kinds of work being done in lightweight materials and better fuel economy from the engines and all kinds of technologies that help get better fuel economy.
What are the other trends you're seeing this year at the auto show?
Well, I think some people were very disappointed in the Detroit Auto Show that there wasn't just a wow vehicle like a few years ago with a Ford GT or a Chevrolet Corvette. But it was a really bread and butter show about sport utilities and trucks. There were a few, interesting new cars. But by and large, consumers are buying sport utilities and trucks. So this was the car show of today of what people are buying. We saw this past year, both in the luxury and non-luxury segments, sport utilities outsold cars.
And is President-elect Donald Trump front of mind there because he's been specifically calling out certain automakers?
Well, yes. Donald Trump was not at the auto show, but his presence was felt immensely. It was during the press day yesterday. He was the talk of the show. Every auto executive was grilled on what does a Trump presidency mean for the auto industry. I got a lot of questions on that. So, yes, he is very much being talked about at the auto show and what his presidency means for the auto industry.
Any answers on that question?
No, even Fiat Chrysler's Sergio Marchionne, who's never with a shortage of answers, said, "You're asking me questions I don't know the answer to."
Hmm.
I think that what we'll have to see is what actually transpires in the next 100 days. What do we think really will happen in terms of tariffs, tax reform, infrastructure spending in the next year? It could have a positive impact on car sales. It could have a negative one. It depends on which way we go.
That's Michelle Krebs, who is senior analyst at Auto Trader. Michelle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Is the power-sharing government of Northern Ireland in danger? Martin McGuinness, a former commander in the Irish Republican Army and part of the Sinn Féin political wing of the IRA, resigned in protest yesterday. Sinn Féin represents Catholics who wanted Northern Ireland to break away from the UK and join the Irish Republic to the south. They fought that long and bloody battle against the Protestant Unionists who wanted to stay in the UK. Now Sinn Féin and the Unionists share power under the Good Friday Agreement of 1998. The BBC's Chris Page joins us from Stormont, Northern Ireland's parliament. And Chris, security issues have threatened that power sharing before. This time it's a green energy program that went way over budget?
Basically, this scheme was supposed to encourage businesses to switch from fossil fuels to environmentally friendly fuels, but the subsidy it paid out was greater than the cost of fuel, and also initially there was no cap on the amount of money that could be paid out. Now, the present First Minister of Northern Ireland, who's the Unionist leader Arlene Foster, was in the firing line over this because she was the minister in charge of the scheme when it was initially set up. So her partners in government, Sinn Féin, called for her to temporarily step down so that there could be an investigation into this controversy, but Mrs. Foster to refuse to do that.
Okay, so is this part of the divide, Protestants and Catholics, or is this what would happen in any other government when an out-of-control payment scheme is revealed?
Sinn Féin have thought for quite some time now that the power-sharing agreement basically wasn't working. Same-sex marriage isn't legal in Northern Ireland. Sinn Féin want to make it legal, but the Democratic Unionists don't want to do that. So Sinn Féin have basically decided enough is enough, and the likely outcome of that is that there'll be fresh elections to the Northern Ireland Assembly.
Well, but this is all happening as people in Britain voted to leave the European Union, while people in Northern Ireland voted to remain. What do you see happening here? Is it possible that we might devolve into the Catholic versus Protestant split in Northern Ireland that we saw during the Troubles?
Nobody is thinking there's going to be an upsurge of paramilitary activity, but everybody would tell you that it's important for the international image of Northern Ireland that the parties work things out. Whether or not they can do that is pretty doubtful at the moment.
The BBC's Chris Page. Chris, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, here in the U.S., President Obama delivers his farewell address tonight, a long tradition that dates back to the country's founding. Here now is Alex Ashlock reports on an event that's part of the transfer of power.
President Obama has already said one goodbye. He spoke at the farewell ceremony held for him by the U.S. military last week.
Of all the privileges of this office, and there are many, I will miss Air Force One, I will miss Marine One. But I can stand before you today and say that there has been no greater privilege and no greater honor than serving as the Commander-in-Chief of the greatest military in the history of the world.
Obama leaves office as the only Commander-in-Chief to complete two full terms with the country at war. So it wouldn't be a surprise if he reflected on that tonight. But some past presidents we associate with war didn't get that chance. Abraham Lincoln was assassinated only days after the South surrendered, ending the Civil War in 1865, and Franklin Roosevelt died in 1945, before the end of World War II. Vice President Harry Truman succeeded FDR, and he made the decision to drop atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, triggering Japan's surrender. Truman bid farewell in 1953, during another war, this one in Korea.
I suppose that history will remember my term in office as the years when the Cold War began to overshadow our lives. I have had hardly a day in office that has not been dominated by this all-embracing struggle, this conflict between those who love freedom and those who would lead the world back into slavery and darkness.
In his farewell, Truman did something most outgoing presidents do. He wished his successor well and urged Americans to support him. Dwight Eisenhower followed Truman into the White House. He was a five-star general who helped plan the D-Day invasion. But as president, when he left office, he did so with this warning.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Eisenhower spoke on January 17, 1961. 3 days later, John F. Kennedy was inaugurated. His presidency ended with his assassination in Dallas in 1963, and his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, took office. Johnson's presidency saw historic progress on issues like civil rights, but dogged by Vietnam, he decided not to run for re-election in 1968. So he used the 1969 State of the Union message to say goodbye.
I hope it may be said 100 years from now that by working together, we help to make our country more just. More just for all of its people, as well as to ensure and guarantee the blessings of liberty for all of our posterity. That's what I hope. But I believe that at least it will be said that we tried.
Richard Nixon followed LBJ into the White House, but his presidency ended in the Watergate scandal. His emotional farewell to members of his administration and the White House staff was impromptu and was forced by his resignation.
You were here to say goodbye to us, and we don't have a good word for it in English. The best is au revoir. We'll see you again.
Richard Nixon on August 9th, 1974. In more recent years, these farewell addresses have reflected the tenor of changing times. After his two terms in January 2001, Bill Clinton described his hopes for the future.
We must remember that America cannot lead in the world unless here at home we weave the threads of our coat of many colors into the fabric of one America. As we become ever more diverse, we must work harder to unite around our common values and our common humanity. We must work harder to overcome our differences. In our hearts and in our laws, we must treat all our people with fairness and dignity, regardless of their race, religion, gender, or sexual orientation, and regardless of when they arrived in our country, always moving toward the more perfect union of our founders' dreams.
8 months later, with George W. Bush as president, the 9/11 attacks rocked the nation and affected everything after. Bush launched the invasion of Afghanistan and later the war in Iraq. He delivered his farewell address on January 9, 2009.
I've often spoken to you about good and evil, and this has made some uncomfortable. But good and evil are present in this world, and between the two, there can be no compromise. Murdering the innocent to advance an ideology is wrong every time, everywhere. Freeing people from oppression and despair is eternally right. This nation must continue to speak out for justice and truth. We must always be willing to act in their defense and to advance the cause of peace.
There are echoes of the very first presidential goodbye in all of these speeches. George Washington's farewell in 1796 was a gesture of humility. The man who could have been king said the people should choose their next leader. He would not seek a third term. Washington also warned of the dangers of partisanship and the influence of alliances with foreign powers. Washington's words continue to resonate literally.
I rejoice that the state of your concerns, external as well as internal, no longer renders the pursuit of inclination incompatible with the sentiment of duty or propriety, and am persuaded, whatever partiality may be retained for my services, that in the present circumstances of our country, you will not disapprove my determination to retire.
Every year, typically in February, a member of the U.S. Senate reads Washington's farewell text aloud on the Senate floor. Senator Chris Coons read his farewell address last year. It's a tradition that started during the Civil War in 1862. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Yahoo may soon go by another name, Altaba. The company announced yesterday that it plans to rename and restructure itself, including having its CEO Marissa Mayer step down from its board of directors if its $4.8 billion sale to Verizon goes through. And that could be a big if, given Yahoo's recent security breach disclosures. Here to explain is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Jason Del Rey is senior editor at Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, tell us more about this and what exactly Yahoo is saying about renaming and restructuring itself.
Sure. So it's probably a bit more confusing than it should be. But Yahoo is, you know, has a proposed sale to Verizon. What's going to Verizon is the core internet assets that probably everyone's familiar with. That would be Yahoo Mail, Yahoo Sports, Yahoo Finance. But Yahoo also owns a stake in Yahoo Japan, which is a separate company, as well as a big stake in Alibaba. And those are not going to Verizon and would be split out into a new public company, basically with no management, that's called Altaba, as you said. I think it's for alternative to Alibaba.
So it's specifically meant to sound like Alibaba.
That's what we've heard. Yes. Mm.
And Alibaba, by the way, the Chinese e-commerce giant, which its CEO or its founder was meeting with Donald Trump just yesterday.
Yeah, that's correct. So Jack Ma is co-founder, chairman, and longtime former CEO of Alibaba. Had a meeting with Donald Trump yesterday where the plan was to talk to Donald about bringing perhaps as many as a million jobs to Americans through Alibaba's Chinese internet marketplaces.
And a lot of people are questioning that number. How would they do that exactly according to Alibaba?
Sure. So the theory is that you know, American products, everything from food like cherries and Alaskan seafood to products from American brands already are sold to Chinese consumers on Alibaba's marketplace. And Alibaba is going to try to sort of increase the number of businesses and even farmers who can sell into their marketplaces. And, you know, the million number seems a little made up to me, but it's supposedly a 5-year goal.
Now, this gets complicated because the Securities and Exchange Commission is currently investigating Alibaba for how it reports its operating data for the Chinese annual shopping festival Singles Day. And at the same time, Donald Trump's pick for the head of the SEC is Wall Street attorney Jay Clayton, who worked on Alibaba's initial public offering. Are there concerns about a conflict if Jay Clayton becomes the head of the SEC?
I mean, I think absolutely. And I think, you know, one would think the prudent thing for him to do would to recuse himself from any investigations into Alibaba since he worked on the company's IPO and one would assume knows the inner workings of their financial reporting pretty well. Could the chief of the SEC recuse himself and still have no, you know, impact on how people under him do their work? I think that's a fair question to ask.
It's also coming at a time when we've been talking about the U.S. relationship with China and Trump, tweeting at China and also having a conversation with the leader of Taiwan, which angered China. And then you've got this meeting with Jack Ma, who, of course, is a very powerful Chinese businessman.
Yeah, I mean, I think Alibaba and Jack Ma's sort of, you know, they're first of all, they're used to sort of government intervention in business, it's much more the case in China than we're used to here in the U.S. And also, they've been talking about bringing U.S. products to China for many years since they went public in 2014. Now that narrative, happens to mesh with what we've heard from Donald Trump and his campaign. And so I think the narrative's aligned and they're using this as an opportunity, A, for press and B, to get the president's ear, frankly.
So, Jason, let's just go full circle back to what we were talking about at the top and Yahoo. Is the sale likely to go through to Verizon in the end?
You know, we think this was a sign that the sale is still likely to go through. Would not be shocked if that $4.8 billion price perhaps comes down a bit because of the two recent huge hackings that have been disclosed. But I'd say that I'd be surprised if the deal doesn't end up happening.
That's Jason Del Rey, who is a senior editor at Recode, joining us from New York. Jason, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.